Now, this evening, I shall continue my discussion of American federalism and talk to you about the way the federal system developed in the United States during its first 150 years or so. And I shall emphasize the conception of federalism, which we call dual federalism, tell you what that conception consists of, and then tell you very briefly how it has declined during the present century, largely during the past 50 years. According to a leading French student of American public law, Professor Panto of the University of Paris, according to him, in the classic Anglo-American doctrine of federalism, the division of powers between the federal state and the member states guarantees to the one and to the others full sovereignty in the domain appropriate to each. The exercise of federal powers, he says, should not infringe upon the area of powers reserved to the member states, and vice versa. Now, this is really the classical concept of federalism upon which the American system was based, and it is this which has generally been termed the doctrine of dual federalism. Now, the division of power between Washington and the state governments provided for in the American Constitution was long dominated by this doctrine of dual federalism. The doctrine was based upon the notion of two mutually exclusive, reciprocally limiting fields of power, the governmental occupants of which confronted each other as absolute equals. Under this conception, both federal and state governments had marked out for them a rigidly defined area of power. And under this doctrine, the proper equilibrium necessary for the functioning of a federal system is secured and maintained by the strict division, by the strict demarcation of federal and state authority. States and nation, the states and the federal government, are conceived of as equal rivals, and the concept of equality is of basic importance. And it is felt that unless there is rigid delimitation of their respective competences, the union itself may be disrupted by federal-state rivalry. And during the first 150 years of American history, it was felt that this was of particular importance so far as federal authority was concerned. It was considered that the reserved powers of the states must be jealously guarded, lest they be swallowed up by the government in Washington. Now, of course, this concept of federalism is more theoretical than practical. The complete division of state and federal power required by this conception has in practice been most difficult to obtain. The line between state and national authority in the American Constitution is not drawn with anything like mathematical precision. You do not have any close compartmentalized version of federal and state powers, with powers enumerated to each and the list a closed final list. Instead, as I stressed on Tuesday evening, the central government is vested with certain express powers, and all other authority is reserved to the states. Now, in some cases, the specific grant to the federal government is intended to confer exclusive power over the subject, exclusive power in the federal government. This is the case, for example, with the power to conduct foreign affairs and with the power to declare and support a war. In other cases, the grant to the nation does not exclude some concurrent exercise of authority over the particular field by the states. And the best example of this is the power vested in Congress to regulate commerce. In our conception, under our Constitution, the power to regulate commerce depends upon the distinction between interstate and intrastate commerce, commerce that is between the states or that affects interstate commerce, and commerce that takes place exclusively within one state. And it is only the former, interstate commerce, that falls within the competence of the federal government under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. And under this conception, while the federal government has authority over interstate commerce, the states have never surrendered their power over economic affairs which take place within their own boundaries. And every state may regulate its own internal commerce according to its own judgment and according to its own view of the interests and well-being of its citizens. Now, under the concept of dual federalism, it has been felt that it was felt that it was necessary to make certain that so far as the regulation of commerce was concerned, the states could not infringe upon the field of the federal government. It was felt that it must be made certain that the federal government could not infringe upon the area of local commerce reserved to the states. And the Supreme Court, concerned with preserving dual federalism against undue encroachments by the government in Washington, the Supreme Court has drawn the line, or it used to draw the line until not too long ago, in this field strictly against the exercise of federal regulatory authority. And the classic case to illustrate the restrictive approach of the Supreme Court to federal power until about 50 years ago is a case which is called Hammer versus Dagenhart, and it is usually known, for obvious reasons, as we'll see, it's usually called the child labor case. This is one of the great cases in American constitutional law. In the case, there was an act of Congress which prohibited the transportation in interstate commerce of products made in a factory which employed children under a specified age. Now, very clearly, the purpose of Congress in passing this law was to provide, in effect, for the suppression of child labor, because the law denied interstate markets to those who used child labor. And Congress felt that if the interstate markets were cut off from manufacturers, they would sooner not employ children than lose the possibility of selling their products outside the state in which they were made. However, in this case, the Supreme Court decided that this law was beyond the power of the federal Congress, because by the law, Congress was trying to regulate the manner in which manufacturing was carried on within the individual states. And though on its face, the law prohibited only interstate transportation, which is plainly interstate commerce, the underlying purpose of Congress was to control manufacturing in the states and, in effect, to suppress child labor in manufacturing establishments in the states. And the court decided that manufacturing in a state was essentially a matter of local concern. This was carried on entirely within the state. Manufacturing, the court held in a number of cases at that time, was not commerce. Manufacturing would be succeeded by commerce when the product was sent into the stream of commerce to its ultimate purchaser. But until it was sent into commerce, it was purely local, and the federal government could not regulate, even though the law at issue on its face, the federal law in this case on its face, was limited to the confines of the express congressional power to regulate interstate commerce. Because on its face, you see, the law had nothing to do with manufacturing. It only prohibited interstate shipment of products produced by child labor. But the court said that was not important because the necessary effect of this act, said the court, was by means of the prohibition against the movement in interstate commerce of these products, the necessary effect was to regulate the hours of labor of children in factories within the states, a purely state authority. Now, what was the practical consequence at this time? This decision was 1918, by the way. What was the practical consequence of this decision in 1918? And the practical consequence, without a doubt, was to render ineffective attempts at governmental regulation of child labor in the United States. And of course, as we all know, by that time, if there was any matter upon which civilized countries had agreed far more than on most any other thing, such as liquor and even drugs at that time, if there was any matter on which civilized countries agreed by this century, it was that child labor was an evil which should be prevented. And despite this, the result of the Supreme Court's decision, as I have said, was to make impossible governmental regulation of child labor in the United States. Now, it is true that on its face, the decision did not affect state power. The states still retained the power to control manufacturing within their boundaries. And so the states themselves could prohibit child labor. But state authority must necessarily end with the boundaries of the given state. And state power is hardly competent to cope with economic activity, which for the most part is national in scope. The essential aspect of the American economy during the past century and a half has been the transition from a local economy in which the states at the beginning were relatively self-contained in economic matters. You had in those days, production was rudimentary. The first great manufacturing corporations did not develop until the middle of the 19th century and really the second half of the century. When you deal with a local economy, local government is sufficient. But the great movement has been from a local economy in which the states at the beginning were mostly self-sufficient. The transition has been toward a national economy, an economy which is nationwide in scope and where products are produced and sold throughout the country. The great products in the country were in 1918 sold throughout the country. The automobiles, steel, other consumer products. Of course, now it's worldwide. But at that time, it had become national in scope. And the states individually could scarcely control, regulate effectively an economy which had burst beyond state boundaries. In addition, you have to bear in mind that regulation limited to that exerted by the states, such regulation must of necessity vary from state to state. Each state will have its own regulatory requirements. And state control is therefore most unlikely to have the uniform character which is necessary for effective regulation of a nationwide economy. You need one central system of regulation, not for everything, but for so many things. And one of them is child labor. Because just think of it, look at it realistically from a state point of view. Many of our states would have liked to prohibit child labor, but they were told by the manufacturers, if you eliminate child labor, if you require us to employ adults only, we will have to pay more. Our goods will cost more, and we will not be able to compete with our neighboring state, which will produce with children, and their manufacturers will be able to sell, will be able to undercut us, as we say. They will sell for less than we do, and other states will buy from them, not for us. So don't prohibit child labor. And in effect, this had a great deal of validity where you did not have uniform regulation. If child labor was to be prohibited, it had to be by uniform regulation, which was national in character. But under the Supreme Court decision in the child labor case, national regulation of this kind was prohibited. And again, the practical effect of the decision was to prevent effectual regulation of child labor in the United States. Now, to us, this seems wholly, almost ridiculous for government to be deprived of this power. But you must remember the basic conceptions, the basic theory of government and economics, which prevailed 70, 80, 100 years ago. The basic theory then was the laissez-faire theory of governmental function. This dominated political and economic thinking in the United States until the Great Depression of the early 1930s. And the result reached by the Supreme Court in the child labor case fitted in perfectly with this laissez-faire theory. Because, as I have shown, to prohibit federal intervention in this case was to exclude the possibility of any effective regulation in such a case. And of course, this was exactly what was demanded by the advocates of the theory of laissez-faire. To them, the economic system could function effectively only if it was permitted to operate free from governmental interference. And this notion of dual federalism, as it was applied by the Supreme Court in the child labor case, this was a necessary complement of laissez-faire in the United States. By excluding the federal government from exercising regulatory authority over child labor on the ground that it was within the sphere reserved exclusively to the states, the American Supreme Court virtually decreed that the subject of child labor should be left only to whatever controls were afforded by the workings of an unrestrained system of laissez-faire. You see, while to us this decision seems anomalous, anachronistic, even absurd, at the time it fitted in with the prevailing political and economic theories. But of course we all know that the theories on which this conception and this decision of the court was based, the laissez-faire conception of government, this conception has proven completely out of place during the present century. And with it, the concept of dual federalism has had to give way in an era of ever-expanding governmental authority. Because you could have this notion, which rigidly excluded federal power from fields such as child labor, you could have this notion only when the exercise of state power was dominated by the doctrine of laissez-faire. Thomas Hobbes, the great English political theorist, one of the greatest in the English-speaking world, in a famous passage he said, Leviathan. Leviathan was his famous work, of course, and Leviathan was his figure of speech to describe the state, because he was talking when the strong national state had first come into existence in the 17th century, he was writing, just after the national state had become strong in the Jean Baudin sense of the term. Now, he said, Leviathan hath two swords, war and justice. Now, we know, of course, during this century, it is almost commonplace that the armory of the state has come to include so much more than these two elementary weapons. The scope and character of government have changed enormously during the present century. Under the Hobbes conception, which was followed, government was chiefly negative. Its main task was to keep the ring and maintain fair play while private interests asserted themselves freely. Today, government has become positive, and it is concerned with functions, roles, which would have been unthinkable to political theorists of 100 years ago. A century ago, the state acted mainly as policeman, soldier, and judge. Today, the state acts also as doctor, nurse, teacher, insurance organizer, house builder, sanitary engineer, chemist, railway controller, house supplier of gas, water, and electricity, town planner, pensions distributor, hospital organizer, road maker, and in such a large number of other capacities that if I was simply to list the functions of present-day government, I would take up all of the time remaining to me this evening. So you have a tremendous change in our conception of the state. The state as a negative power to the state acting in this new positive role, exercising this fantastic number of functions in all these different areas of public health, public welfare, public morals, and so on. And if the state is effectively to execute the many functions which modern public opinion has required it to assume, the state can only do this by intervening in social and economic affairs upon a national scale. In the United States, as in other countries, governmental action limited to the local level would hardly prove effective where problems which are national in scope have to be dealt with. And of course, however, in my country, action by the federal government was difficult because of the Supreme Court decisions applying the concept of dual federalism, such as the decision in the child labor case. And for the government in Washington to be able to effectively exercise regulatory authority upon the national scale demanded by contemporary conditions, for this to happen, the abandonment of the doctrine of dual federalism was required. And this came about largely because of the great economic depression of the 1930s, when it was seen dramatically that the concept of laissez-faire, upon which the operation of governmental authority in the United States had been based since the founding of the Republic, laissez-faire was now seen very clearly to be inadequate to meet the problems presented by the great economic depression. And it was widely felt throughout the United States that the economy could only be revived by the intervention of the federal government. And the need was met by the so-called New Deal of the administration of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, which took office in 1933. And the New Deal involved a degree of governmental control from Washington far greater than any previously attempted in the American system. And there were many important regulatory measures enacted by the New Deal, providing for detailed governmental regulation of the economy. regulation of manufacturing, regulation of agriculture, regulation of mining, regulation of labor conditions, and so on and so forth. From a laissez-faire system, we developed into, very quickly, in a very short period, we developed into a system in which more and more regulatory authority was exercised from Washington. And of course, when Washington tried to regulate local manufacturing, local agriculture, and so on, it was acting in a manner which had been held unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in the child labor case. And the Supreme Court decided in several cases, particularly a very important case in 1935, the Supreme Court decided that the measures, the New Deal measures of the Roosevelt administration were unconstitutional, but these were the last vestiges of these decisions, particularly this one, were the last vestiges of the doctrine of dual federalism in the United States. Because the need for national regulation had become so apparent, so urgent by that time, that even the Supreme Court gave way, and the tremendous need for national authority to deal with the economic crisis soon had its effect also upon the jurisprudence of the United States Supreme Court. And the court, starting with decisions in 1937, the court began with those decisions to remove the limitations which dual federalism, as applied in decisions such as the child labor case, had placed upon federal action. In 1937, the Supreme Court upheld a federal statute regulating labor relations as against the claim that it conflicted with the constitutional authority reserved to the states. In 1940, the court upheld an act of Congress regulating the coal industry. And of course, that law is just like that in the child labor case, because coal production is local under that case. And in upholding the federal law regulating the coal industry, the court said, and I'm quoting, "Congress under the Commerce Clause is not impotent to deal with what it may consider to be dire consequences of laissez-faire. It is not powerless to take steps in mitigation of what in its judgment are abuses of cutthroat competition." A direct judicial repudiation of the conception of laissez-faire. Then in 1941, the American court went even further and expressly overruled its decision in the child labor case. And in the 1941 case, there was a law of Congress called the Fair Labor Standards Act. Under this law, minimum wages and maximum hours are fixed for employers and employees throughout the country by the federal government. And the law prohibits the shipment in interstate commerce of products manufactured by employees whose wages are less than the prescribed minimum or whose hours of labor are more than the prescribed maximum. And if you understand this law, you see it is exactly like the law which was declared, which was ruled unconstitutional in the child labor case. The difference being that here, the law prohibited the transportation and interstate commerce of goods produced by employers who did not meet the wage and hour standards. In the child labor case, the law prohibited the transportation and interstate commerce of goods produced by employers who hired children, who used child labor. And in the child labor case, the court said, as I told you, that the law was an unconstitutional attempt by Congress to regulate the manner in which manufacturing was carried on a matter reserved exclusively to the individual states in which the manufacturing took place. In its 1941 decision, which is called United States versus Darby, the Supreme Court refused to follow the child labor decision and said instead that that decision rested upon an outmoded conception of laissez-faire, and that conception was outmoded, and the decision must be considered overruled. And the court went on to say that the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, under which, as I told you last time, all powers not granted to the Congress are reserved to the states, the court said that the 10th Amendment to the Constitution did not really have any effect upon this case. And the court said, to quote them, the 10th Amendment states but a truism that all is retained which has not been surrendered. And of course, the 10th Amendment was the very foundation of cases like the child labor case and the doctrine of dual federalism upon which it was based. And to look upon the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution as a mere truism, this is to destroy the basis upon which dual federalism rested. Under the present view of the Supreme Court, the Constitution, and specifically the 10th Amendment, no longer requires a complete dichotomy of federal and state power, with the exclusive authority of the states serving to limit the area in which federal action may be taken. And this has had tremendous impact on the power of the federal Congress to regulate interstate commerce. And it's this power, by the way, which is the key domestic power of the federal government, because all laws and regulations, all federal actions which regulate economic affairs are based upon this commerce power. And under the recent jurisprudence of the Supreme Court, the rigid division between state and federal power, which served to preclude federal regulation of local economic activities, this has been completely abandoned. And the court in the Darby case stressed that the power of Congress over interstate commerce is not confined to regulation of commerce moving between the states. It extends to those activities intrastate, within the state, which so affect interstate commerce as to make regulation of them appropriate by Congress. And what this means in practice is shown by the subsequent case law. Under the cases since 1941, during the past 42 years, the Supreme Court has upheld regulations from Washington of activities which appear clearly to be local in character, because the court has been of the opinion that they might have some effect upon interstate commerce. Under contemporary conditions, however, in a national economy, the economic system is so interconnected in its parts that there are few, if any, local business activities which may not have some effect, some repercussions upon commerce which extends beyond state lines. And if that is true, federal regulation of local commerce is no longer prohibited in the American system. And this is the view of the Supreme Court. There are a number of important cases. For example, in 1942, you had a federal law which regulated the price of milk produced and sold entirely within a state. How does this come within the commerce power? The court said this is a valid regulation because the milk within the state, the intrastate milk, is sold in competition with milk transported from outside the state. And so you have enough of an effect upon commerce, upon interstate commerce, to justify federal regulation, even of the purely local activity. And This is true of most local activity, if this is enough. Almost all local economic activity has at least an indirect effect upon interstate commerce, and this means that there is little, if anything, in the American economy that is beyond the regulatory authority of the Congress. In 1942, the court dealt with a federal law providing for regulating federal regulation of the production of wheat by farmers. And in this case, the law was applied to wheat produced and consumed entirely on the farm, on this particular farmer's farm. It was never sold. But the court said even here there was an effect upon commerce for two reasons. One, if the farmer did not produce the wheat which he consumed, he would have bought the wheat in the marketplace, and his purchase would have had an effect on the market for wheat, including wheat grown and sold interstate. And even more important, wheat consumed on the farm, as the court put it, overhangs the market. What did the court mean by this? The farmer consumes the wheat himself. He and his livestock consume the wheat on the farm. And they may do that if the price of wheat is low. But if production is limited elsewhere, which causes the price of wheat to rise, if the price rises high enough, then the farmer will sell the wheat. And it's not this farmer alone. There are many, many thousands of farmers who will do this. And then that will, the increased wheat on the market will immediately depress the price of wheat. And from this point of view, Congress might feel that wheat grown and consumed on the farm, if wholly outside the federal scheme of regulation, this would have a substantial effect in defeating the congressional purpose to stimulate the wheat market by having wheat sell at higher prices. Now, these decisions show how far the Supreme Court has gone during the period since a case like the child labor case. For the older view that federal power over commerce could not be exercised over local transactions has been substituted the view, the notion of a plenary power of the federal government over commerce. If wheat produced by the farmer solely for his own consumption on the farm, if this can be regulated by Congress because of its possible effect upon interstate commerce, however indirect it may be, there are in practice no restrictions upon federal regulation of even so-called purely local commerce. And the American system today in this area is not based at all upon a division of sovereignty between governmental equals. So far as economic regulation is concerned, the American federal system is characterized by the predominance of federal power. There is no longer an exclusive area of state authority over commerce within which federal authority cannot be exerted. The cases I've been talking about show that federal regulatory power is now all-pervasive. It can be exerted over any subject chosen by the Congress, and it is no objection to the exercise of federal power that it may come into conflict with the accustomed powers of the states. Now, there is another power of the federal government which has become of increasing importance in changing the equilibrium between federal and state power. And this is the power to tax and the power to spend. The Constitution expressly gives the Congress expressly the power to levy, the power to lay and collect taxes in order to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. And this clause confers tremendous power over the government in Washington. This is true Because the power to tax, and even more so, as I'll show you, the power to spend, can be used as significant regulatory instruments. And, for example, Congress may use the power to tax to regulate different aspects of the economy and of the society. Congress uses the power to tax in order to control agricultural production. Taxes are levied upon farmers who produce more than the amount which the federal government desires to be produced by them. Or you have a very inventive use of the taxing power in a 1953 case. In that case, Congress provided, passed a law which imposed a tax on all persons engaged in the business of professional gambling. And under this law, all persons who were professional gamblers had to pay a certain tax each year, and they had to register with a federal agency when they paid the tax. Now, on its face, this is a tax law, but the real purpose had nothing to do with the securing of remedy. The real purpose was to help in the suppression of professional gambling, because the law was intended to place the gambler in a dilemma. If he did not register and pay the tax, he would commit a federal crime, and he could be prosecuted under this federal law. But if he paid the tax, then he would be, in effect, admitting that he was engaged in the business of gambling, and at that time, this was prohibited. Gambling was prohibited in every state but one. And so, if he paid the tax, he would, in effect, be confessing that he was violating state law. And so the object of the law was not at all obtaining of revenue from the tax. The idea, the object, was to regulate gambling, and more than that, to eliminate professional gambling. Despite this, the Supreme Court upheld the law. A law, a tax law, it said, does not cease to be valid because it discourages or deters the activities taxed. The tax may have a regulatory effect, but it is a tax law, and it will secure revenue, even though the revenue may be very small. And in practice it was, because it didn't work. They didn't pay the tax, and there were very few prosecutions. But under the court's decision, the court will not look behind what is formally, on its face, a tax law in order to determine whether the raising of revenue is its primary purpose. And under this approach, the federal government can use the tax power for non-revenue purposes, and the power to tax can be used as a significant regulatory tool. But there's more to it than that. The power to tax, of course, enables the federal government to obtain funds, to obtain revenue. And the power to lay taxes to get the revenue, to obtain the revenue, includes, of course, the power of the federal Congress to provide for the spending of federal funds. And the federal government, during the past 50 years or so, has used its spending power to obtain a position of some dominance over the states. Now, federal grants, the grant of subventions by the federal government to the states, is not new at all in the American system. It goes way back to our early history. For example, in 1837, there was a large surplus in the federal treasury, something we have not seen almost during our lifetimes, but in those days they had surpluses. And in 1837, Congress passed a law distributing this surplus to the states. in proportion to the number of representatives which they had in Congress. And this was the typical case in the early cases when it arose in the early part of American history. Congress would provide for grants to the states without any conditions. You had a fundamental change of approach in 1862 when we had a very important law passed by Congress. It so happened it was during the most severe emergency which the American Union has ever faced, during the darkest days of our Civil War, when it looked as though the Union would be destroyed. Still, President Lincoln and the Congress were looking ahead to the future, and they thought that the promotion of education would be of tremendous importance to the country as it was growing. And so they provided for a grant of public lands, lands owned by the federal government, a grant of federally owned land to the states, on condition that the states establish colleges teaching agricultural and mechanical studies. And the great agricultural colleges in the United States, many of them of the highest level academically, and their establishment has led in large part to the tremendous success of American agriculture. All this stems from this law, which is called the Morrill Act. But notice, Congress gave the land to the states, but the states would get the land only if they established colleges teaching agricultural and mechanical sciences. And so here you have, for the first time, a law which provides for federal grants upon condition. And this has become common in the American system, and it has been particularly true since the economic crisis of 1929, because very few of the individual states had the financial resources needed for the vast programs of relief and rehabilitation, which had become necessary for the revitalization of the economy. And only the government in Washington, which alone could levy taxes throughout the country, could obtain the needed funds. And so you had set up during the Depression, during the 1930s and early 40s, you had set up an extensive system of federal grants in aid to the states, and grants to enable the states to rehabilitate their economies and to provide measures which would give aid to individuals who would be unable to take care of themselves. For example, you had laws providing funds to the states for the establishment of unemployment insurance systems, for systems of public assistance, money and other services provided to people who are below a certain economic line, provision for extensive schemes of social insurance, old age insurance, disability insurance, and so on and so forth. And the funds were provided by the federal government, even though the systems were in large part administered by the states. But now the largesse of the federal government was no longer dispensed without qualifications. Instead, substantial conditions were imposed by Washington upon the states which accepted its grants. And these conditions, in effect, amounted to federal supervision of the schemes of economic revival undertaken by the states. Now, there have been a few cases in the Supreme Court in which challenges were made to this type of grant upon condition on the theory that Congress was in effect regulating the states and Congress was in effect controlling how the states were to administer their laws of unemployment insurance, welfare assistance, and so on. But in all these cases, the Supreme Court rejected the challenge, saying that the basic principle is that Congress has the constitutional power to spend money, and it can fix the conditions under which its money shall be spent. For example, in the most recent case, a case in 1976, you had a law which does not involve grants upon conditions to the states, but it shows how the court now looks upon the spending power. Under this law, you had a federal provision of federal financing for presidential election campaigns. And it was claimed that such payments at public expense were contrary to the general welfare and therefore unconstitutional. The court rejected the claim. The court said, Congress has the power to spend, and whether the means chosen by Congress appears to be unwise or unworkable, this is irrelevant to the court. Congress had concluded that the means were necessary and proper to promote the general welfare, and the court would decline to go beyond the congressional decision in the matter, provided that it was reasonable. Governmental decisions to spend money to improve the general welfare in one way and not in another are not confided to the courts. The Supreme Court said that the choice belongs to Congress unless it can be said that the choice is so clearly arbitrary that it cannot be accepted as a valid exercise of judgment, that what Congress has done is completely unreasonable. Otherwise, the congressional spending authority must be upheld. And since the court has said that it's up to Congress not only to spend the money, but if it can spend the money, it can fix the terms on which the money is to be spent. Of course, this means that Congress can grant funds and impose conditions before the grants will be made. And during the past half century, the provision of federal funds to the states, the provision of grants in aid upon condition, has grown by leaps and bounds. And today, this provision of federal funds to the states is an integral part of the American governmental system. Indeed, according to one of our leading constitutional jurists, the federal spending power is probably the most important of all congressional powers in its impact on the actual functioning of the American federal system. By 1949, 15 years roughly after the federal government started to deal with the economic crisis, by 1949, 15% of all funds spent by the states were derived from federal subventions. By 1980, 31 years later, national assistance to the states exceeded $90 billion, and federal assistance constituted about 25% of all state expenditures. And of course, there is a tremendous significance in this growth of the grant and aid system, tremendous significance of this growth for American federalism. Of course, there are great advantages. The states cannot individually obtain the necessary funds. If we are to have a national highway system, it is desirable that the federal government grant funds to the states to build highways within the states. If we are to have a proper educational system, it is desirable that the federal government grant funds to the states to enable them to improve their schools, their colleges, their universities. If we are to have an adequate system of welfare assistance to poor people, it is desirable that the federal government grant funds to the states. And it's only because of federal aid that many of the states have been able to act effectively in these areas, such as highway building, education, social welfare, and other areas as well. But the important thing is that the growth of the federal grant and aid system has helped to alter the balance between state and national governments in the United States. Federal aid has been extended only at the price of ever-increasing control by Washington over state legislation and state administration, because the federal government normally, at least until very recently, I'll discuss this in my last lecture, the federal government until recently has made these grants to the states, and the states obtain the funds only if they meet the conditions laid down in the federal law. And the conditions are detailed, and it does amount in large part to federal regulation of the manner in which the states will build highways, conduct their educational systems, and also the way the states will administer their systems of welfare and other social assistance. And in effect, as it has been put, the old adage that he who pays the piper calls the tune has a great deal of truth in relation to grants in aid by the federal government. And from an overall point of view, this means the grant in aid system means a growth and even an aggrandizement of federal power. Relying, as the system does, on the superior fiscal resources of the federal government, the grant and aid system has led to an increasing concentration of power at Washington. And what I've been saying this evening indicates that federalism in the United States is no longer controlled by the concept of equality between states and nation. The equilibrium between state and federal power has been completely altered. More and more, the American system has come to be characterized by the dominancy of the government in Washington. I've analyzed this development in the fields of regulation of commerce, and more briefly, in the tax power and the spending power, particularly in spending of federal funds for grants in aid upon conditions to the states. In all of these fields, the theme has been the magnification, the recent theme. Remember, this is only 50 years old, but 50 years is not that short a period. The theme during the past 50 years has been the magnification of federal authority. However, in political as in natural science, extremes beget extremes. Action which moves too far in one direction ultimately provokes an equivalent reaction in the opposite direction. There is a political and a juristic equivalent of Newton's first principle. Even constitutional law cannot escape the law of the pendulum. And the pendulum has recently started to swing back in favor of state power. The changing law in this respect was signaled in 1976 by the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in National League of Cities against Ussery. And I will talk about that decision and what it means in my next lecture. Thank you.